Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, or it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from NHK Japan, France 24, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with NHK World Radio Japan. Japan set a new all-time temperature on Tuesday. 40 degrees centigrade equals 104 degrees Fahrenheit. Wednesday was the 80th anniversary of the U.S. dropping an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, killing 140,000 people within a year. The U.S. space agency NASA will fast-track efforts to build a nuclear power plant on the moon. China and Russia have a joint plan to build one there later. South Korea and the United States are postponing military drills, allegedly because of high temperatures. Israeli media say that Netanyahu plans to completely occupy the Gaza Strip because of Hamas. NHK Japan.
In Japan, severe hot weather is expected to continue on Wednesday, a day after recording its highest ever temperature. Japanese weather officials are urging the public to take thorough measures against heat stroke. The Japan Meteorological Agency says a temperature of 41.8 degrees Celsius was recorded on Tuesday in Isesaki City, north of Tokyo. The mercury rose to 40 degrees or higher at 14 observation points in the Kanto region, including Tokyo.
Wednesday marks 80 years since an atomic bomb devastated Hiroshima. People across Japan have paused to remember the victims. People came to the Peace Memorial Park hours before the official ceremony began.
That was an unspeakable scene. I will never forget what I saw, no matter how much time passes. Wars still happen today, not just one. There are wars everywhere. I just wonder if anything can be done.
I have never skipped the August 6th memorial. I always come, every year. There's been suffering these past 80 years.
I don't know how much longer we can come together. It's harder for her to talk. So I need to listen more to keep her memory alive.
Hiroshima fell silent at 8:15 a.m., the same moment the bomb was dropped in 1945. The heat and radiation from the blast destroyed the city, killing an estimated 140,000 people by the end of the year. Many who survived suffer from cancer and other diseases related to radiation exposure. About 55,000 people attended this year's ceremony. Prime Minister Ishiba Shigeru also spoke at the ceremony. He said Japan is committed to a world without nuclear weapons.
When I visited the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Museum, I renewed my resolve that these unbearable ordeals and memories should not be allowed to fade away and must be handed down through future generations. Here in Hiroshima, to realize a world without nuclear war and a world free of nuclear weapons and bring about everlasting peace, I pledge once again that Japan will do its utmost.
U.S. space agency NASA will fast-track efforts to build a nuclear reactor on the moon. It now plans to have a facility up and running by the end of 2029. The agency cites a need to counter similar moves by China and Russia. NASA's acting administrator, Sean Duffy, issued a directive to accelerate plans to build a reactor on the lunar surface. He said the facility needs a minimum output of 100 kilowatts to secure the power supply necessary to support activities on the moon. China and Russia have already announced a joint plan to place a nuclear reactor on the lunar surface by the mid-2030s.
We're in a race to the moon, in a race with China to the moon, and to have a base on the moon, we need energy.
NASA's original target was to construct a 40-kilowatt reactor by the early 2030s. It's unclear if the new plan will be possible, given massive budget cuts for NASA recently proposed by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. The South Korean and U.S. militaries are shelving parts of a large-scale annual drill until next month. Officials cite extreme temperatures, but local reports say the move may really be in light of Seoul's attempts to ease tensions with Pyongyang. The Ulchi Freedom Shield exercise will run from August 18th to 28th. South Korean military officials said on Thursday about half of the field training exercises will be moved to September after a comprehensive assessment, including the weather and defense environment. High-ranking North Korean official Kim Yo-jon, who's also leader Kim Jong-un's sister, denounced the joint drills last month. South Korean President Lee Jae-myung wants to resume dialogue with Pyongyang. He suspended anti-North Korea loudspeaker broadcasts over the border shortly after taking office in June.
Israeli media say Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is leaning towards completely occupying the Gaza Strip. It marks yet another escalation in the fight against the Islamic group Hamas. Negotiations between the two sides have been underway in Qatar. The U.S. had proposed a 60-day ceasefire, including the release of hostages held by Hamas. But the Israeli delegation withdrew at the end of July. Multiple Israeli media outlets reported Netanyahu notified his cabinet ministers of his intent Monday. He reportedly used the words, occupation of the Strip. The reports also say military operations will be carried out, even in areas where Israeli hostages may be held. Netanyahu reportedly told the chief of staff of the Israel Defense Forces to resign if the plan does not suit him. Netanyahu said on Monday he will convene the security cabinet this week to direct the IDF on how to achieve the release of the hostages and destroy Hamas. People in Gaza are suffering from severe food shortages. There are fears that if the military operation is expanded, the humanitarian situation there will worsen.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan. On shortwave, they're heard at 10 p.m. at 13710 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. They're also available at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. And all the times they announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. Next, France 24. Arwa Damon, founder of the International Network of Aid, Relief, and Assistance, is interviewed following Netanyahu announcing commercial aid might be allowed to re-enter Gaza. She describes the scale of the starvation and the flow of aid actually needed. She says only the U.S. has the capacity to influence Netanyahu. The UN Environmental Program is hosting a summit attempting to create a treaty to combat plastic pollution. An interview with Professor Bethany Carney Almroth on the severity of the problem with plastics and the human health risks that are manifesting now. France 24.
Well, joining us now on the program is founder of the International Network for Aid, Relief, and Assistance, Arwa Damon. Thanks very much for being with us on the program.
There really is only one solution for Gaza, and that is for hundreds of trucks of humanitarian aid to be let into the Gaza Strip alongside whatever Israel decides to let in terms of commercial goods. Otherwise, we're going to continue to see people to starve to death.
I mean, critics have already accused Israel of kind of throwing it out there, if you like, as a new diversionary tactic to perhaps get people away from talking about the other issues.
Yes, and it wouldn't be the first time that we've seen these sorts of diversionary tactics being put into place by Israel. And quite frankly, up until now, they have all been very, very successful. One of the many reasons why we're seeing what's unfolding in Gaza unfolding today, with a growing number of people who are effectively dying of hunger-related issues growing every single day, and the ongoing bombardment of the Gaza Strip. It really boils down right now at this stage to the United States and whether or not President Donald Trump and the White House are actually willing to put the kind of pressure that needs to be put on Israel. Look, there's a reason why 600, you know, senior former Israeli officials have sent a letter, not to their own government, but to President Donald Trump. And among these 600 names, there are also the names of former Shin Bet and Mossad officers. And the letter is effectively saying that the war in Gaza needs to end because Hamas is no longer a threat. Hamas has been defeated. And so it begs the question that if 600 former Israeli officials, including very senior security officials, are declaring that Hamas is effectively gone, finished, and not going to be posing a threat to Israel, what exactly is the Israeli government's aim right now, other than to continue to starve and bombard the entire population of Gaza?
So do you think the answer then lies at this stage with the U.S. rather than with Israel?
I think the answer all along has pretty much been in the hands of the United States. Right now, the Trump administration and previous to that, the Biden administration. It is only the U.S. that has the capacity to pressure Israel in the way that Israel actually needs to be pressured, because it is only the U.S. right now, pretty much, if you take a look around, you know, even Western countries and Israel's former allies, it's only America that is standing as strongly as it is with Israel. And it is, of course, America that provides Israel with the largest volume of defense funding and also with weapons, to include bombs and various other items, deadly items that Israel has within its arsenal. If Israel were to actually lose the U.S. as its ally, it would really struggle to continue this current trajectory that it's on when it comes to how it's dealing with Gaza. And this is not necessarily something new at all. But up until this point, the U.S. has really failed, which is why so many do view, myself included, the U.S. as being complicit in the war crimes that are being carried out by Israel and Gaza.
Tell us how you would describe what the situation is like in Gaza now.
I never have been able to do that, not since I first set foot in Gaza well over a year ago, and I still cannot today. It is something beyond what even the best Hollywood producers and directors could imagine for an opening scene in some sort of zombie apocalyptic movie where everything has been reduced to rubble. And in the middle of the various different shades of gray and destroyed buildings, you have the listless, limp, slogging along bodies of young and old, searching through any scraps of garbage for a little bit of meal, or rushing as if they're part of some twisted hunger game towards the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation hubs that have been described and are in fact death traps, or towards any aid food convoy that is coming in only to be met with gunfire. You have mothers, babies, children, the elderly, men who are all crying out of pain because they are hungry. You have people who are dying of communicable diseases, of infections, because their bodies are too weak to fight. How do you even begin to describe that? How do you even begin to justify that?
And you talked earlier on about how the aerial aid drops are not helping at all. Is any aid getting in that you're really seeing, and is it being distributed to those that need it at all?
Very little. Look, if we take a look, for example, at the number of aid trucks that got in yesterday on Monday, they're roughly 14% of what Gaza needs on a daily basis. If we count all of the aid trucks that have been let in over, say, the last month, that is pretty much what Gaza actually needs in a single day. And we're really not at a stage where we should be even saying, you know, oh, okay, so the trickle is a little bit of a bigger trickle. Because Gaza needs hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of aid trucks every single day for a very long period of time, for years even, to begin to reverse what has actually been happening. You don't just open a border and allow in a handful of trucks and say, look, we're reversing the impacts of severe malnutrition and severe starvation, because we're talking about weeks and weeks and weeks of people of all ages trying to sustain and trying to survive on a very, very limited number of calories. And bodies are quite literally wasting away. And who gets the most most impacted initially by starvation and by malnutrition. It is children under the age of 5 and children and adults who have pre-existing chronic and congenital issues. Their bodies quite simply do not have enough protein, enough nutrients, enough anything to be able to keep their vital organs functioning. And we see them, and we have been seeing them, severely wasting away. The only way to reverse this is to allow aid in, is to deliver very specific treatments to avoid something that's called refeeding syndrome to those who are experiencing the impacts of malnutrition and starvation at its worst sort of stage on the spectrum, and then to allow for that aid to be sustained. The only way the chaos that we're seeing in Gaza when it comes to the arrival of aid convoys, the only way to sort of subdue that chaos is at that point when people know that they're not going to be deprived of aid again.
Alwa Damon, thanks very much for being with us on the program today. Alwa Damon from the International Network of Aid, Relief and Assistance.
Now, the UN Environmental Programme is hosting a conference in Geneva aimed at clinching a landmark treaty to combat plastic pollution. Organisers are aware the negotiations will not be easy, but they insist a deal is within reach. Plastic pollution is so ubiquitous that microplastics have been found on the highest mountain peaks, in the deepest ocean trenches, and even found in the human body. We can now bring in Bethany Carney Almroth, professor in the Department of Biological and Environmental Sciences at the University of Gothenburg. Thank you so much for joining us on the program today. Why should plastic pollution be a concern for all of us?
Well, you mentioned it a little bit in your opening. Plastic pollution is found on every part of the entire globe in all of our environments, including the human body. And not only is the planet contaminated, but plastic is causing harm. It's causing harm in the environment. It's causing harm in humans. People are exposed across the entire life cycle. And the crisis has become existential for some people and countries in the world today.
And what are some of the health risks with plastic pollution?
One of the most well-established health risks from direct exposure is exposure to chemicals. There are more than 16,000 chemicals present or used in plastics. We know that 4,200 of those have hazardous properties and more than 10,000 lack data. And of those that we know something about, we know that they can be associated with increased cancer risks, with disruptions in hormone systems, with metabolic disorders, with reproductive disorders. So there are well-documented health impacts of chemicals and plastics. But plastics can also have indirect effects. They're destabilizing the Earth system. They're impacting the environment. They can affect food security. They can lead to increased flooding. And the fact that plastics are made from fossil fuels ties them very closely to the climate crisis that we're also facing.
Why do you think it's so difficult to reach an agreement to combat plastic pollution when, as you said, all countries and everyone is affected?
Yeah, there's a few reasons for that. One is that plastics life cycle is very complex, and plastics as materials are very complex. It's not one thing, but rather thousands and thousands of things. And the plastics life cycle begins with extraction and production. That's very closely tied to the fossil fuel industry. Since 98-99% of plastics are made from fossil fuels. It involves all of these chemicals that I just mentioned. These are transported across the world. It involves trade. It involves production of products that we use in every part of our lives. Plastics are quite literally ubiquitous in all that we do. So there's no one simple solution. We will need many solutions. And there are a lot of different contentious ideas about what should be included in this treaty, what its scope should be, whether or not we should be looking at production and chemicals and so on.
Are there certain age groups who are more susceptible to the risk of plastics?
We do know that children are more vulnerable than adults. They have developing hormone systems and organ systems. We know that chemical exposure and microplastic exposure occurs already in utero. So humans are exposed throughout their entire lives from before the moment that they're born. And we know that early exposure to a lot of chemicals can have effects that are seen first later in life.
And from a public health perspective, how dangerous is plastic pollution versus other environmental risks?
That's a difficult question to answer, and I can't say that I have a direct answer to that, but I can say that there are ties between plastics and a lot of other public health issues that we're facing. Mm. So one would be air pollution. Plastics during their production phase contribute to the release of greenhouse gases, but they're commonly incinerated in the waste phase, and incineration might occur in plants that are more regulated, but open burning and uncontrolled burning is also very, very common, and this leads to release of particulate matter, of micro nanoplastics into the air, but also of dangerous chemicals that become aerosolized, things like dioxins, which are very cancerogenic. So people can be exposed to these again during the entire life cycle. But plastics are, as I'm explaining, tied to a lot of other health crises. We also see plastics contributing to biodiversity changes with invasive species. There's new microbial organisms that are growing on the surface of plastics, including human pathogens. So there's a lot of interconnections between plastics pollution and other public health crises.
When it comes to plastics, you mentioned that it's tied to the fossil fuel industry. Is that why the lobby is so immense to take on?
Yeah, the petrochemical fossil fuels lobbyists and interest organizations are here, and they have vested interests in this treaty. Of course, fossil fuels are important for with important ties to economies, and these companies themselves also have vested economic interests in the continued production of plastics and petrochemicals. So there's definitely a factor in why they are here.
Indeed. Bethany Akani-Amo, thank you so much for joining us on the program this evening.
Those interviews were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English, as well as most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the Shortwave Report or could help support this program, like a listener in Upper Lake, California did this week, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com, or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever donated to keep this freely distributed show in the airwaves. Please help if you can. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Brazilian President Lula da Silva has criticized former President Bolsonaro as a traitor for defending the 50% tariff announced by Trump. Lula also restated the need for an alternative currency to the dollar for international trade, one of the main proposals of the recent BRICS summit. Radio Havana, Cuba.
During his speech at the 17th National Meeting of the Workers' Party in Brasilia, Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has directly criticized figures opposed to the government and leaders of the national and regional right wing who have defended the tariffs announced by the Trump administration against Brazil and have once again shown their traitorous and anti-popular nature. Lula said, "We are experiencing a political excrescence, a guy who campaigned, wrapped in the Brazilian flag, is now wrapped in the American flag, demanding tariffs against Brazil," referring to Eduardo Bolsonaro, a representative of São Paulo for the Liberal Party and son of former President Jair Bolsonaro. He described Eduardo Bolsonaro as an enemy of Brazil, along with all of those calling for sanctions that will directly affect the Brazilian people. The statements came in the context of the entry into force of the 50% tariffs unilaterally imposed by the United States on Brazil, and the South American giant's calls on the Trump administration to reverse the tariffs. Lula's government has chosen to avoid direct confrontation and increase its trade with other countries within the framework of solid trade relations, such as those with China and India. Lula said Brazil will continue attempting to negotiate the repeal of the tariffs with the United States. During the meeting marking the inauguration of a new leadership of the Party of Workers, the Workers' Party, which was sworn in by the former mayor of São Paulo, the president, Lula da Silva, referred to the trade war initiated by the United States and affirmed that Brazil will continue its attempts to negotiate the repeal of the 50% tariff increase. Lula affirmed that this will be done with pride and sovereignty and will allow the Brazilian people to recover their national symbols as well as to strengthen their ties with other countries. Lula said, Brazil is no longer so dependent on the United States. We have good relations with other countries. I will not forget our relations with the United States, which are more than 200 years old, but I will also not forget that they helped stage a coup d'etat. He also alluded to the need to create an alternative currency to the dollar, one of the main proposals at a recent BRICS summit in Rio de Janeiro. Lula said, I will not give up on debating the need for an alternative currency for trade with other countries. We don't want to fight, but we are not afraid. The United States is very big. It is the most bellicose country in the world, the most technologically advanced, the one with the largest economy in the world. But we want to be respected. We have economic and strategic interests. We want to grow. And we are not a small republic, he said, defending Brazil's ability to evade U.S. restrictions thanks to its size and wealth. The Brazilian president criticized the use of political issues by the United States to impose economic taxes, referring to the tariff increases announced after it was revealed that the Brazilian prosecutor's office recognized former President Jair Bolsonaro as guilty of organizing a coup d'etat, and U.S. government figures such as Secretary of State Marco Rubio came out in defense of Bolsonaro. However, the Brazilian president affirmed that there are limits to negotiations with the United States. He said, in this fight we are having now with the U.S. tariffs, I have a limit to my ability to fight the U.S. government. I can't say everything I think I should say. I have to say what's possible. And he denounced Washington's tariff policy as seeking to punish the country economically. During the meeting, the president made an important statement for his party and supporters. He said he will run for re-election if he feels healthy. I need to be completely healthy for me to run and experience what happened to Biden. Never. I say I'm 80 years old with an energy of a 30-year-old, and you can believe me. If I'm a candidate, I will continue to win. He called for strategic vision and unity from the Workers' Party and emphasized that the opponents on the other side will also be organized. He affirmed that this government is beginning to see concrete results in the lives of Brazilians, citing that Brazil has recently eliminated the hunger map again. Just a few weeks ago, the executive branch in Brazil launched a 4 billion real, about $842 million plan to support the urbanization of dozens of governments and areas in a demonstration of its interest in improving the situation of Brazilians living in extreme poverty. Lula da Silva was critical, emphasizing the results are still insufficient. He said things have not reached the people yet. There's a lot of publicity inside the presidential palace, but little on the streets. We have a lot of work to do.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140. And from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6,000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury and staying in a house connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.